Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg, joined once again by the returned Athletic Mets beat writer, Tim Britton. Tim, it's good to have you back.
It's Ted? Ted is your name?
I'm still Ted.
I spent the last 2 weeks being like, what is that dude's name? Yeah. I can't remember it. It's nice to be back talking to you, Ted, about the New York Mets.
You know, we joked the last time you were here about how tumult would obviously follow your departure, and it took them maybe less than 24 hours. Maybe you were still on the plane when the Mets scored 9 runs in a game against the Nationals. And then at a time when their offense was still a very, very bleak looking picture. And then immediately swallowed up their own headlines because Javi Baez, as has been much discussed on this show and just about everywhere else, very matter-of-factly explained that their thumbs-down celebration was aimed at the fans and to boo the fans. We're over that now because the Mets have hit quite a bit better since, and because they had for all things considered, and I think that most Mets fans, despite the hype around the Subway Series, I think most people you speak to have a fairly reasonable perspective about it, but it does feel good, I think, in the streets of New York when the Mets take 2 out of 3 really exciting games from the Yankees over the weekend.
And I think in particular when the Yankees are in it's a really important part of their season as well. This isn't just like the Yankees are cruising 10 games up in the AL East and the Mets managed to win a series from them. It's the Yankees, this could really put a dent in the Yankees postseason chances given the state of the American League wildcard race. You know, those games were the atmosphere at those games is always different, especially at Citi Field. You get the full house like they had on Saturday. It was a nearly packed house on Sunday night. So just the fans are into it from the start. You get the chance back and forth. It's just a more charged atmosphere to begin with. And then you had obviously Saturday night being taking that to another level. And then the drama on Sunday, which was, Francisco Lindor coming up in the 8th inning, and I had typed out a tweet in case he hit a home run, just to be on top of things, thinking like that would be pretty remarkable, right? And then as I finished it, there was the ball going to right field, and I was like, huh, how about that? That's pretty cool.
Were you the first to tweet it? Did you tweet it first? Were you the first?
No, because the national broadcast games, the Fox game on Saturday and the ESPN game on Sunday have such a delay from the live feed that you don't want to tweet those things right away. That generally I try to wait 10 to 15 seconds because people, I got a complaint on Saturday night that, I tweeted out the final score before the game had ended on TV, and you always feel bad about that because you understand that fans
No remorse, no mercy. You're it's Twitter, right? Like, you got to get that out there first. You got to be the one to ruin it for as many Mets fans as possible.
Everyone is like, there's no glory in being the first to tweet a thing that happened on the field.
Except that everybody does it. Why does everybody do it?
Because they don't understand that there's no glory.
Fair enough.
Like, if I'm breaking a story, yes, I want to be the first one to do it. If someone says a funny quote or something to all of us, I do want to be the first one to tweet that out. If it's just something that, like, I don't understand, I'm going to get onto my beat writer high horse here. I don't understand when other reporters, be it on the Mets beat or elsewhere, use, like, breaking news in capital letters in a tweet for something that we all have. like, you know, breaking news. Luis Rojas says this is the lineup or something.
Breaking news. The Mets put out a press release that they've already tweeted.
Right. Like, I'm going to, if I use breaking news, it's because I am the one who is breaking it. This tweet is the news. And no one else has it.
I think that's fair. I want to talk about the Yankees series a little bit more, especially that Sunday game. But I do want to ask you if you've ever experienced the phenomenon of being at a baseball game and like sitting there watching the game and seeing something on Twitter and becoming concerned that you are the one on delay. Like not.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. There are things I'm like, what is that about? And I'm sitting there looking at the game. I was like, are they a pitch ahead? And then I'm like, no, I am literally the one watching the game. It is straight, like, you know, I remember when I covered one Super Bowl. It was the Patriots-Seahawks Super Bowl, and Malcolm Butler had the interception late in the game. And it was like it was something so unbelievable to happen in the moment watching it live that, like, part of me needed to see the highlight of it to, like, confirm that this is what happened. Like, I need to see what Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth said about this. Because did this happen? Like, I saw it happen. Everyone around me is reacting as if it happened. But it took me so by surprise that the Seahawks passed the ball.
Yeah, I get the instinct sometimes to hit, like, the little DVR, like, go back 10 second button.
Can I see that again? Because, you know. And that happens when I'm watching games. Like, you hear the crowd cheer for something and you look up and you're like, what's going on? What did I miss? And you realize like it's the wave or something, that there is nothing in action that you're missing. So it can be, it's disorienting that way, that you feel like the online or the TV experience is more real than the actual in-person experience.
This is the world we live in 2021 on that Sunday game. And I should say we're speaking on Tuesday morning after the wind has been taken out of the Mets sails a little bit by Adam Wainwright with a really nice outing and a win for the Cardinals on Monday. But that Sunday game, which was, of course, the one in which Francisco Lindor hit three home runs, the signature game of Lindor's season, obviously, perhaps the best game, you know, certainly the best offensive game of his career. And I think, you know, I don't think the Mets are going to make the playoffs this year. I know they're 3.5 games out. I know there's still a chance. I think if you look at like the playoff odds, it's, you know, 5 to 10%. So I don't want to dismiss it out of hand, but I don't reasonably think it's going to happen. That game alone makes me feel so much better about the team going forward, because it feels like whatever was going on with Lindor, you know, the slump, which we talked about at length, and, you know, sort of, you know, just sort of a middling season thereafter. And then this, he clearly had a role. I think no one doubted that Javi Baez was really going to bat for Lindor when he made his comments on the fans. And you're looking at Lindor and seeing 10 more years on his contract. It feels a lot sunnier today than it did even 3 days ago.
Yeah, well, it's the old, you know, in the Bronx, it's earning your pinstripes, right? You're not really a true Yankee until you do this huge thing as a member of the Yankees. Like, it doesn't, you know, the Yankees could sign Albert Pujols tomorrow, and it'll be like, I don't know if this guy's a Hall of Famer, but if he goes 3-for-4 against the Red Sox and gets a game-winning hit, maybe then he'll actually be a good player. You know, and it's the idea that, like, whatever you've done before doesn't matter until you do it in New York. And look, Mets fans, you know, I think you go in the Northeast, Boston, New York, Philly, are the fan bases that they will boo you 2 weeks into your tenure there if you are not hitting. And that's what happened with Lindor, and it snowballed for 2 months on him. I think players, when they come to a place like New York, expect that, you know, it's going to be hard. The fans are going to be on you more than elsewhere, more than in a place like Cleveland. But I think it always still catches them off guard when it's like the third home game of the season and they go 0-for-4 and strike out in the eighth inning. Then there's some boos, you know. And look, Michael Conforto heard them early in the season as well, and that's a guy who has done well for this team and this franchise in this city. It happens, and so. You know, it's a really nice big step for Lindor that endears him to the fan base. You know, he'll have that moment. It doesn't erase everything that happened before it. I think he was wise to say, I don't think Met fans forget anything. which I think was funny. And if he goes back into a slump, no one will care that he hit 3 home runs in 1 regular season game in a season in which the Mets did not make the playoffs. No one says much about, you know, like Robinson Cano didn't win fans over with his 3 homer game against the Padres a couple of years back. Different circumstances of the game itself, but if Lindor still doesn't perform the way they expect him to perform, the way he himself expects himself to perform offensively, this is just a reprieve rather than a real turning point. You hope it's the turning point, you know. Luis Rojas said, this is the Francisco we expect. This is the Francisco the fan base is going to get for 10 years. You hope that's the case.
Yeah, certainly, 3 home runs a night. Fan, 3 home runs a night, I'll take.
That'd be nice. But, you know, if he is hitting 250, 330, 400 next year as his slash line into June and July, we're going to be back in the same spot.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right that if it had come on behalf of the Yankees, we would be talking about that as his true Yankee moment. But his true Met moment came on August 29th when it turned out that he was, directly antagonizing the fans. That's the true Met moment. But since that true Met moment, and obviously it's a tiny sample, and obviously it's bolstered a heck of a lot by the fact that he hit 3 home runs in 1 game. But, 277 batting average, 397 OBP, 702 slugging. He's got an 1,100 OPS despite a very low batting average on balls in play since it came out that he was, like, overtly frustrated. And I don't know. I don't believe that that's the turning point. I don't believe that it could ever work like that. But I wonder if, it took a little bit of a load off to have Baez come out and say that and to have it just be out in the open that I'm not happy about the way I've been treated here.
I don't know, because that would seem to, increase the spotlight on him, right? You know, that's generally how it works here.
Yeah, but it's, unburdening yourself of your, thing that, you're trying to shake it off, you're trying to smile through it the whole season, and I don't know, I could understand it being, a little bit relieving to just finally be like, you know what, screw this. Give me a freaking break here.
I think the sample size that's more meaningful for him is probably you go back to basically Memorial Day, the end of May. I think it's May 29th on. He's hitting 262, 353, 511. That's an 864 OPS. That is pretty much in line with who he's been in his career through 2019 or so. Through 2019, his career high OPS is 871. He's been largely himself since then. And again, those numbers, the numbers were an 800 OPS, then he has the Sunday night game and jumps to 864. But that's how it works. That's how math is. I think as a Mets fan, you can be a bit more optimistic about where he is offensively. He had 2 really bad months, but since then he's been significantly better. Those 2 bad months are going to drag down, what his season-ending numbers are going to look like. They're going, in perpetuity, this will be cast as an extremely disappointing first season for Francisco Lindor with the Mets. But you hope that these last 4 months, if he can finish the season strong, propels him into next season, into the kind of Carlos Beltran rebound season that I think every Mets fan hopes he has.
Yeah, I was going to draw the comparison to Beltran because, right now, actually, the wins above replacement is identical. Obviously, Lindor's got some season left to play. But it's similar in that, it wasn't Beltran's first year, I don't think it was a disaster given the contract. But if you look at the numbers, it's not a disaster season. It's not like he completely fell apart. He just wasn't good. And with Lindor, like that, and the three home run game helps a lot. But now you look at the numbers and you're just like, okay, like this is just sort of the low end performance that you can expect from Lindor. And, you know, this is the floor. Like now let's see with Beltran, the ceiling came the very next year. Who knows what will happen with Lindor moving forward, but I think you just come out of it with like a much better vibe that he is not like, it's not going to be a 600 OPS. It's going to be a 720 OPS, and you live with that because the defense is really good. And because now you've seen what he can do when he is firing on all cylinders.
And it's important to know, like the run scoring environment itself is different this year than it has been in years past, you know, like, looking at Lindor's numbers in 2016, you know, his first full season in the majors, he had a 794 OPS. That's 60 points higher than it is this year. It's only 3 points higher in OPS plus because different run scoring environment, different ballpark. I'm actually interested in what his home road splits are this year. I don't think he has the stark ones that a lot of other players on the Mets like Pete Alonso have. Yeah, he's actually been better at home than on the road by 100 points of OPS, probably, again, because of Sunday night. But you know, I think the Beltran case is a like the classic big market example of how you can respond. There's the thought that like 3 weeks into a guy's tenure in a big city, you know whether or not he can play there. And I think there are enough counterexamples led by Carlos that it's, you know, your legacy in a big market is not defined by your first month there. And it can change over time and you can do a lot to change it, especially when you've got 11 years with it.
And, you know, I hate the sort of big city narrative aspect of it anyway. Like, I will allow that there's something to that. Like, yes, there have been times when I went to Cleveland's spring training when there were no beat writers there. And Terry Francona came into the office and it was like a TV guy and me. And they just, you know, and like, I didn't even have any questions. I was just sort of dropping in and I'm sitting there at the table with Terry Francona. I got to come up with something, you know, like that doesn't happen in Port St. Lucie. There's no day when there are just no reporters lurking around. And so like, that is a big difference, but it's ridiculous to suggest that like, and I don't know that anyone did suggest it, but like Lindor's played in huge games before. He's been to the World Series. They made the postseason four times while he was in Cleveland. It's not like he was playing for like the Marlins in obscurity. He was playing for a really, really good team that just happens to play in a smaller media market, but nonetheless a team with a whole lot of attention on it.
Yeah. It is wild sometimes when you cover a different team that doesn't have the level of beat reporter coverage. The first time that happened to me, I was, you know, the intern year that I covered the Mets in 2009. I only covered home games, and obviously home games, you have a larger group of reporters at home games than on the road for the Mets. And so you're used to like 20 reporters being in the clubhouse, and I had to cover the Rockies on the other side. This was right before the Tony Bernazard thing. You were on your honeymoon. Mm-hmm. And it was like me, the TV reporter, and Troy Rank from the Denver Post.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jim Tracy was the Colorado manager. So, like, when I walked into his office, it's only the three of us. Like, I introduced myself because it was awkward not to. And then, you know, the TV reporter asks a few questions. Troy asks a couple questions. And then Jim looks at me. He's like, what you got, Tim?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I forget what question I sputtered out with. Yeah. I did not know a lot about the 2009 Colorado Rockies at the time. It was probably about Jason Marquis. But yeah, it's a different environment for players in that context. You know, I used to not think, I just think that this was an overblown narrative. Like it's, you know, how much different it is in a big market, but I think there are real tangible things that affect how a player performs there. I think it makes slumps snowball a little on a guy because, you know, in a different market, you might have an 0 for 16 and you don't have people on top of you for that. Whereas in New York or Boston or Philly, you get people on top of you for an 0 for 12. You know, it happens a little earlier that your slumps get noticed. And, you know, just a basic thing, a practical thing that you don't think about too much when you, as a fan watching these teams, is the travel is much worse for like the Mets, Yankees, and Red Sox than a lot of other teams because they play a lot of Sunday night baseball games, which fans hate and players hate them even more because you end up with bad travel. You know, Sunday is your natural getaway day for road trips and you lose that.
I mean, I was asleep like an hour before Lindor hit that home run.
Right. You know, the Mets had that obviously with the turnaround from a home game Sunday night to a road game in San Francisco on a Monday night earlier this season. They're fortunate in that the back-to-back Sunday night games that they're, you know, the Yankees and now the Phillies, they don't have to go anywhere the following Monday. I guess they're going to Boston on Sunday night, but they have an off day. And, you know, you're on a coast, so you get a lot more West Coast trips. You know, I remember talking to Rick Porcello in Boston. I've talked to Trevor May about it this year. Those were guys who played in the AL Central. And you're not used to like having 6-hour flights and 3-hour time difference changes when you play your start your career there, that it's just a little bit different to get used to. And that's another thing that, you know, it's a big market does affect you in that sense, that there is just that heightened spotlight and it's a little tougher on your body travel wise than a lot of other places.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I've seen that made a bunch of times in terms of the Seattle Mariners who wind up traveling like twice as many miles as any other team just because they're so isolated geographically. Just your point about the media scene, an anecdote. It was my first spring training not covering the Mets when I was at first started at USA Today, just across the Goodyear campus of the Cleveland Indians facility, covering the Reds, and again a scenario where just not a lot of people were there. And the Reds media relations guy came over and was like, "Hey, who are you hoping to talk to?" And so like I was on the spot, you know, like I hadn't really thought about it that much, and I said, "Joey Votto." You know, just like, there's no way this guy's going to give me Joey Votto. And he's like, "Oh, Joey's in the trainer's room right now." I was like, "Oh, okay. You know, whatever. Like, this is like, I'm, you know, par for the course. I didn't expect that." And he's like, "Let me go grab him." And goes in and Joey Votto comes out with his hip all wrapped up. And he's like, "Hey man, what can I do for you?" He's like, "Wow." Like, it is a whole new world out here. In terms of Lindor, I think it's a series of good points. I think that, any situation where you're given that type of deal in these circumstances, especially with the new owner and a franchise that's been through the ringer a little bit over the last few years, like, yeah, there's going to be a lot of pressure. It now seems like whether that was a part of what was going on in April and May, like, we're past it and we can move forward. And it brings up, I think, another point. And you missed again, like the throes of the Javi Baez disgust among some Mets fans. There were people that night like were saying like, "I'm canceling my season tickets unless you cut this guy." Now he has like 150 OPS plus for the Mets. He's been their best player. Am I crazy to think like they should bring this guy back?
I mean, I think that's a distinct possibility. I would be a little bit worried about thinking that the guy he's been a Met, which is, you know, has he gotten, how many plate appearances does he have as a Met? Is it
125?
125. Like, we have a larger data sample of who he is as a hitter, and that's the guy you're buying on. Is not these 125 plate appearances. It's the 6 years with the Cubs. So I think you don't want to. You don't want to make a move for him. You don't want to re-sign him long-term to a nine-figure deal just because he played really well down the stretch for you.
This guy can play in New York.
I think, you know, I think that when you decide whether you want to re-sign him, I think you're looking at how he fits and how he complements the rest of your roster. Obviously, you know, I think he's the advanced metrics are split on him. I think he's still a solid defensive player, probably above average and better than what they've had at second base for a few years. If he's going to play there, he brings a different element to them clearly on the base paths. This is not a good base running team, Ted. It's one of the it's probably the worst base running team in baseball, depending on which metric you use. And Javi Baez is a good base runner and an exciting base runner, creative base runner. Having a guy like that can help the other guys start to become better base runners when they see like that it's possible to advance two bases on a single or three on a double. I think there are scenarios in which he fits. It really comes down to like how much does Steve Cohen want to spend this winter? Is he going to be, you know, I think there will be 29 owners in I know there will be 29 owners in baseball who are going to hide behind the CBA uncertainty to justify not spending too much this winter. Is Steve Cohen going to make it 30 for 30, or is he going to be the one out of 30 who says, you know, the heck with that, I feel fine paying whatever penalty, and I'm willing to go over whatever the luxury tax is going to be. I feel fine spending a lot of money and then adjusting to the penalties after that, because you know this team has holes. I don't think you can just go into next year and bring back and run it back with this crew.
Why not?
Because I think you've seen enough from
because they're 72 and 73.
Right. And like we can talk about like how, you know, how promising this offense was last year. Yeah, it was a 60 game season. They went 26-34. You know, I think there's been a lot of like this core that you've thought is building something. You're basically judging it off of two really good months at the end of 2019. Like that is the high of this core. And to be fair, like that was built largely off a great starting rotation that no longer exists here. Mm-hmm. That was when you had DeGrom, Syndergaard, Stroman, Wheeler, Mats all pitching well. You know, Mats is in Toronto, Wheeler's in Philly, Syndergaard hasn't pitched in 2 years, Stroman's a free agent. You might only have DeGrom back from that crew. So I don't think you can run it back, but, you know, you're probably going to be giving qualifying offers to Noah Syndergaard and Michael Conforto. Stroman, out of the four free agents you have, might be the one you want to re-sign the most. You can make a pretty strong case he's been their most valuable player, at least from a day-to-day performance perspective, because I think DeGrom still has the higher wins above replacement, but you haven't seen him in 2 months. And Stroman's ability to just reliably pitch innings is more valuable now than it's ever been. So if you bring back all four of your free agents at higher price points, you know, you add stuff in arbitration, are you basically just bringing back the same roster from a team that went 500 and expecting it to be a different? I think that's part of the whole picture with Baez. It's not just does Javi Baez work for this team. I think he does. But how do you build the whole roster and where does he fit in that?
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
I got a question that's related from a listener, but I want to just follow up on something you said. The defensive metrics are split on Baez this year?
I believe they're down. They're more down on him than they have been in the past. I actually haven't looked at them in a couple. I haven't looked at them since he came to the Mets. So I haven't seen what he's at second base. But I think he's one of those players where the remarkable plays that he makes, like that he's an incredible tagger and those kinds of things. I don't know if they get captured by the advanced metrics the same way. And just kind of like the everyday play, he doesn't make quite as consistently as some other guys. So he makes some errors here and there. He does have a fair number of errors this year. But I still think, you know, he's a plus defender for you, especially if he's playing second base.
Yeah, I was going to say that feels to me like a blip that I don't really buy, like, because it just, you know, like I like trust defensive metrics to some extent, and I know that they are in many cases, like, or at least over time, probably better than your eyes, but like there are just times when I just simply don't like. I mean, this is, if you ask the people who created these stats, they say you need like 3 years worth of a sample before you can say for sure how someone is as a defender. And so to me, like, I don't know, I watch Bias play and I say, this guy's a good defensive player. Like, and he's certainly like a, to me, he looks like an excellent defensive second baseman. And we haven't seen a ton of him at shortstop since he's been with the Mets, but certainly by reputation, a good defensive shortstop as well. I would say that would be one thing about his game that I was not worried about moving forward.
Yeah, like I'm looking it up now. Defensive run saved had him positive at shortstop, +5. Outs above average had him +2 at shortstop. I'm trying to see if I can find him at second base as well. He was 2 defensive runs saved at second base with the Mets. UZR has had him slightly negative at short this year and positive at second. So, yeah, I think the overall picture is of still a positive defender, a guy who I think with Lindor gives you as good a middle infield as you've probably had since the greatest infield ever.
Yeah, I think something that's very instructive, and they don't keep the stats anymore. I think they stopped after 2019. But if you ever go down to the Inside Edge fielding tab on Fangraphs, it gives you like sort of the granular data for how they come up with some of the defensive metrics, and you see like they put the plays into buckets of how likely they are to be made. And you know, a guy for the hundreds and hundreds of routine chances he'll see in a season, there are all of like 40 plays that really test a player's range across the course of a season. And so, you know, maybe the guy has the capacity to make 20 of them or 30 of them and just so happens to make 15 of them that year. It's such a small number that there's going to be like pretty huge amounts of variance, but it doesn't mean you're a bad defender if you just didn't have, like in this case, you didn't happen to make those few extra plays. I don't know. I always found it sort of like, you know that in concept, but when you actually look at the numbers, like, Baez in 2019, which was a more or less a full season at shortstop for him, of the unlikely plays, like he had 9 unlikely chances according to that inside edge fielding, and he made 3 of them, so he performed well. But like, you just don't, you know, if he made 0 of them, it wouldn't be that weird, but it would knock him in those stats. So it's an interesting thing to look at. The question is sort of related. It comes from Chris B at CWB on Things on Twitter. He says, the Mets need a third baseman badly. What realistic options do the Mets have internally, or who are good targets in the offseason?
So your internal options are Jeff McNeil, mm-hmm. who I think has been like their preseason plan at third base for a few different seasons and hasn't stuck there for various reasons. And I think you start to wonder a little bit about his ability to play that position regularly, because they've kind of avoided putting him there this year after he struggled a bit in a very small sample this year. JD Davis, who, to his credit, had that series in Chicago earlier this year where it just seemed like he was completely unplayable at third base, and has been better since then. I remember when he made an error in like early August, and I was like, oh, that's, you know, it's crazy. It's his first error since mid-April. And then I realized he missed a lot of time in there, Ted. So it didn't make it. It wasn't a great stat.
Yeah.
It's still a small sample for him. He's never going to be a plus defender there. It's basically just him, whether he's completely untenable there or if he can make do at third base. You know, Jonathan Villar has certainly played well at the position this year, and he's given them a little bit of a different look, kind of along the same lines as Baez, a guy who brings speed, makes a few more outs on the bases than you would like with that speed.
I would go ahead and say way more outs than you would like on the bases with that speed. Go on.
Yeah. He's a free agent, but you know, a guy that they could consider bringing back, even if it's not for an everyday role. I wonder what the market is for guys like that, because it seems like even if you have a really nice season the way VR is having, that teams are loath to give those guys like a deal and say like, okay, be our starter for the next 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he could be available. And then you've got some big names. You know, you've got that entire shortstop class.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is guys like Carlos Correa and Trevor Story are going to want to sign as shortstops. My guess is Corey Seager is going to want to sign as a shortstop, at least at the start of his deal. You can probably rule those guys out. But, you know, Marcus Semien is a guy who it wouldn't surprise me if he played second or third for his next team. Chris Bryant is going to be a free agent. My guess is he signs with the Giants because that seems trending in that direction, but he's going to be available. I mean, these are all, if you're signing one of these guys, that level of free agent, you're not signing Baez in my mind. I don't know that you can have that would be like a $700 million infield before you've done anything with Alonso.
Do it.
Right. If you sign Baez, you're probably likelier to go with a cheaper option at third. Eduardo Escobar is going to be a free agent. That's a guy who is kind of an underrated switch hitting performer over the last several years with Arizona and now Milwaukee. Those are your options. I would think that they're probably not going to go huge at third. I think if they're making a big move this winter, it's bringing back a guy like Baez. It's replacing Conforto in the outfield if he rejects the qualifying offer and they decide not to go after him. Or maybe it's trying to find a center fielder and then you kind of move your outfield around that. So I would say third base is not their top priority in the winter, even not from a position player perspective, because I think starting pitching is probably going to be the top priority regardless.
I think you sign Baez and Carlos Correa, and you go like Baez at second, Lindor at short, Correa at third, and you have the greatest defensive infield of all time and three really awesome hitters. What do you think about that?
Would that be the greatest defensive infield of all time?
Yeah, they'd be on. There would be three. You have three like viable above average major league shortstops spaced around the infield. Like you could just, Pete Alonso could stand on first base. Like he would never have to stray because you could completely reimagine how you shift with three guys with that much range.
Or you've got to trade for Manny Machado in that instance to get him to play right field for you on a regular basis.
Yeah. Well, so in my baseball future, it's like there really aren't positions. It's just sort of like an amorphous shift where like your best defender is always going to stand where they're most likely to hit the ball.
What will that do to the world of newspaper box scores?
Yeah, I mean, probably it's time for them to go. While I was at USA Today, they stopped running the box scores, and there was like, there were people who were so very, very mad about that. Like, we got letters.
Yeah, I mean, you don't get emails from the people who are mad about the box scores. You get letters.
Yeah, because they're online.
There are people who cut them out and paste them in a book, and I sympathize with that. That's, if I had started doing that as a kid, I can imagine myself still doing that on a regular basis if I still got a newspaper and if I had glue and a notebook.
It's a lot of scrapbooking.
I mean, considering like newspapers now, I was at my parents' house like last month or something after the Mets had one of their double headers. I'm trying to remember which one it was, but the local newspaper did not have the first game of the double header score, like, and that game, it was like a 4 o'clock New York Eastern time game, did not make the late edition of the local newspaper, and that was kind of eye opening to me.
I don't know if this is news to you or not, but it's been the print side of the newspaper industry has been struggling of late.
I have heard that. Rumors are rumbling.
Yeah. To go back to Chris's question about third baseman, I do think like that so much of that question depends on what they do. It just seems like there are so many potential directions they could go, as you alluded to, because if they want to bring back Baez, for example, then like it seems like McNeil goes to third base. It seems like there are a lot of options. There are also up to three. I mean, and none of these guys, and you know how I feel about planning long-term around prospects, I don't think that any of these guys is a certain thing, but with Mark Vientos, with Beatty, and with Mauricio, Mauricio's a shortstop for now, but like he's going to have to move somewhere, presumably, if and when he's ready for the majors. So, I don't know, there are, like, third base is maybe the one position where they do have some depth in prospects.
Yeah, that's a really good point to make. That's another reason why you probably don't sign someone to an 8-year, $200 million deal to play that position for you. I think you know, as a team, when you're looking organizationally, you make the decision, like, where is the big investment? The big investment for the Mets has been at shortstop. You look at the rest of your core and you think, like, who are we going to extend out of this core? Alonso is the one that really stands out. You know, you can think about it with Nimmo,
because
he's going into his last year next year. You can think about it with Smith and McNeil and Davis, although it's less likely given the seasons that they've had this year, and you don't know where they fit positionally because you don't know what the rules are going to be next year. And so you have the place where you invest a ton of money at short, places where you invest a lot of money, that'll be first base eventually, that'll be somewhere in the outfield, and then the places where you want to be paying someone the league minimum. And, you know, third base can be that spot. If you believe in one of those guys to be there, you know, opening day of 2023, basically, as your go-to third baseman, Beatty probably has the inside track on that. I think Vientos might be closer to the major leagues, but he's probably less ready to be a major league third baseman, from what I've heard. Mauricio's a little farther away; he just got up to Double A, but it's easier to plan out for the future of having one of those three take over when there's three of them, rather than like you're pining all your hopes on one guy taking the job and running with it. But that's another reason I think that they probably will not be making a huge investment in the hot corner this winter.
Tim, thanks for making a huge investment in returning to the New York area and joining this show again.
It's nice to be back on the podcast, I guess.
We will be back later in the week to talk more about the Mets and all of these same things, probably. If you've got questions, please do hit us up on Twitter. Tim's at Tim Britton. I'm at OG Tedberg. Or you can email asktedberg@gmail.com. Tim, peace out.
Adios.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.